History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. He was young, handsome, and highly educated in the best English schools. He was a respected professional and a first-class amateur athlete. However, many historians think that he was also a serial killer, the Victorian equivalent of the modern-day Ted Bundy. His name was Montague Druitt, also known as Jack the Ripper. Druitt's handiwork included the slaughter of at least 5 women of ill repute in the East End of London, but there are still a lot of mysteries about his motivations, his thinking, and the circumstances behind his demise. To explore all this, I'm talking with Christine Ward Agius and Jonathan Hainsworth, author of the new book, The Escape of Jack the Ripper, The Truth About the Cover-Up and His Flight from Justice. We'll look at how a bloodstained Druitt was arrested, yet bluffed his way to freedom by pretending to be a medical student helping the poor, how Druitt confessed to his cousin, an Anglican priest, how Druitt's family placed him in a private, expensive asylum in France, only for him to flee when a nurse blew the whistle, and how Druitt's identity was concealed by his well-connected friends and family, thus hatching the mystery of Jack the Ripper. So I hope you enjoyed this discussion about history's most infamous serial killer. Christine and Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Hello, how are you going?
Thanks for having us on.
Okay, well, we don't talk about serial killers much this story, but in terms of a historical figure, this one is very important. So looking into the origins of Jack the Ripper, historians have argued about different candidates for his identity, and you have strong reason to believe that it points to one particular figure. But before getting into that, I'm curious about Jack the Ripper himself. Now, murder exists throughout history. The Old Testament account pins it at the first children who were ever born, Cain killing Abel. The mental illnesses that would cause someone to be a serial killer or the personal issues that would cause someone have existed throughout history. So we've always had serial killers with us, but Jack the Ripper, for whatever reason, has become the poster child and the most famous serial killer. Even though others have done worse than him, they've been perhaps more sadistic. So what do you think it is about Jack the Ripper that made him a media sensation like no other and made him perhaps the most famous serial killer in history?
I think that it goes in stages. And at the time of the murders, he was perceived by some that he might be a terrorist inspired by socialistic ideals or ideology who was trying to use evil by murdering women driven into prostitution by poverty in the worst slum of the worst slum of the East End of London in 1888, that is Whitechapel. And the perception by some was that he is murdering these women whose lives were already destroyed by poverty, and social reformers wondered and hoped the answer was no, that this was a deranged social reformer trying to make the ruling classes do something about the terrible conditions of London's East End. And if that's the case, he had quite a bit of significant success in the media and in terms of the government saying, well, what can we do? Perhaps we can have better housing or sanitation. And then I think that by the Edwardian era, it had become something rather different. He was seen as an English gentleman, deranged, a doctor, middle-aged, a recluse, very rich, who periodically, when he was foolishly let out of private asylums, he would attack and kill so-called fallen women in the East End, and he drowned himself in the Thames just as a Scotland Yard's police dragnet was closing in on him. That was what Edwardians thought was the truth, that there was no mystery as to his identity, although they did not have his name. But that was considered appropriate because he killed himself. He could never have due process. He could never have the protection of a trial. And then after the First World War, you had movies like The Lodger, which had been based on the novel by Marie Belloc-Lowndes. And you also had the idea that it had been solved and that the Ripper was a suicide. It all fell away. And I think that what remained was the contrast between the perceived well-to-do nature of the murderer compared to the women and the area in which he was killing, and that contrast, plus the name Jack the Ripper, which was created by a couple of journalists as a hoax letter to the police to increase circulation, I think that is what has caused it to be remembered generation after generation, until you finally get to the 1960s when the drowned doctor's name was revealed to be Montagu Druitt. And because he turned out to be a drowned lawyer, his identity, like as the solution to the so-called mystery, did not gain traction with the public or with popular culture. And instead, the whole subject went in all sorts of different directions, which have also kept it alive as an industry of books and movies and TV documentaries and this podcast and our book. But we would argue that that was a misperception of the whole story. It was actually solved by a police chief in 1891, and the solution was shared with the public, although fudged to protect the killer's respectable family. And once you understand that, you realize that all the other suspects and all theories and all the other rather outlandish claims about dodgy DNA and royal conspiracies and famous painters setting up clues in their works of art are exactly that. They're all in the wrong direction.
That's very interesting. And I want to return to that of if the evidence is as strong as you claim, what is gained by not having a consensus on his identity, because apparently there is something to be gained. Well, maybe we could explore that now. Why do you think? Because do people like the idea of the mystery, or they maybe want a more exotic background of Jack the Ripper or a different one than Montagu Druitt provides?
Yes, I think there's quite a bit of truth in what your question suggests, that they want it to be a mystery. And as to his identity, how could he not have been caught when he is murdering defenseless women in a very small part of London, crawling with police after the second and third murder? And why wasn't he caught? And perhaps he can be identified from this distance. And so I think that it's because each time people claim that their new book or movie or documentary solves the mystery, that's what, you know, gains the attention of people and readers and the media, and we've read those books too. But the difference, we would argue, with our book is that we're not claiming to have solved the mystery. We're arguing there is no mystery. It was solved by a handful of Victorians at the time. Could they have been wrong? Of course, people are often wrong about things, but it's a very unlikely thing for them to be wrong about. And therefore, we regard them as sources that are credible. They believe they had solved it, and this was their solution that we've tried to recreate.
Well, it's very interesting. This could almost be a companion episode to an author I spoke with about Hitler's death, and the evidence of where Hitler's remains are outside of Berlin are quite incontrovertible. But that doesn't mean that the History Channel in the United States doesn't have a 14-part series about how Hitler and Eva Braun escaped Argentina, because in the FBI files, there's fourth-hand hearsay that someone claims they saw Hitler, and it's such an intriguing tale that people will still glom onto it, despite all evidence of the contrary. So these things just don't die if people want the story to be true hard enough. Well, let's look at Montagu Druitt specifically. So please tell me about his background, and we can get into the evidence as well.
Montagu Druitt was part of a very successful family. They all came from Wimborne in Dorset, which is in the West Country of England. And his father and his uncle were doctors, and his uncle was a very famous doctor, Dr. Robert Druitt, and his name was well known amongst all people in England. And although his work concerned sanitation, and he'd written a lot of pamphlets about prostitution, He was very concerned with public health. He was most famous because he was an expert on wine, and his name was everywhere. If you look at the old papers from that era, even after his death, he was always quoted in advertisements recommending certain brands of wine. And alcoholism was a big talking point in Whitechapel and everywhere in that Victorian era. People drinking too much, violence, domestic violence, and neglect of children. And there was also the temperance movement, which was really growing in force. So Dr. Robert Druitt, he had an idea that drinking pure wine and good quality wine could be good for your health. And so his name was everywhere. So Monty Druitt grew up with a famous person in his family. He was a high achiever in his early years. He went to Winchester College, which was an exclusive boys' school, and he did very well at school. He was a great sportsman. He was in the debating team, very competent. And he was also the prefect of chapel in his final year, which was a very high achievement for anyone. He then won a scholarship to New College, Oxford. And things seemed to fall down a little bit once he got there. So whether he had problems there or distractions, he still seemed to be popular. He played a lot of sport, but his academic achievement at college, at Oxford College, didn't really live up to expectations.
We think that he was in a bit of a state of flux, and so he took on a teaching position at a small boys' school in Blackheath in London, which is about 6 miles from Whitechapel, and he did a civil service exam, public service exam, and he could have got a job in the bureaucracy of the British state, but he never took up a position there. We also argue that the sources indicate that he did some medical training, attended some anatomy classes. Perhaps he thought about being a doctor like his father and uncle, and then changed his mind about that. And finally, he made the move into law and became a defence barrister. And the problem with that was you often couldn't make money from it because your clients were broke. But he did make money from it. He was a very successful barrister. And when he drowned himself in the River Thames, he left quite a substantial estate behind. So in those years of graduating from college, he becomes a lawyer. He's a successful lawyer. He's also a sports person. He's in a county cricket team. He's man about town sort of thing. He's handsome. One source we have says that he could be very charming, but we also believe that those people who knew him, family members, later a police chief, who knew him posthumously, they all agreed that he was also a serial killer.
Well, let's look into the forensic evidence. One point you make is that a blood-stained Druitt was arrested but bluffed his way to freedom by pretending to be a medical student. Can you tell me about this?
We do not have, for example, an arrest record with Mr. Druitt's name on it. What we have is a theory that he was arrested or came to the notice of police in Whitechapel, and his name was taken down. And of course, he spent his life having people say to him, "Oh, Druitt, are you related to Dr. Robert Druitt?" "Yes, I'm his nephew." And in a society in which everyone's obsessed with pedigree and reputation, that would have carried a lot of weight. We have sources like Sir Melville McNaughton, the police chief, who indicates in his memoirs of 1914 that there were two streams of information that came to him about the suspect he doesn't name, but it's obviously Druitt. And in the first stream, he's not much. And in the second stream, after he's been dead for a few years, he is everything. He is the solution. Well, what could be that first stream? Sir Melville McNaughton's successor, Sir Basil Thompson, had not only gone to Oxford, he'd also gone to Winchester. No, that's a mistake, isn't it? Christine's signaling to me. He'd gone to Oxford and been a student there with Montague. Anyway, Sir Basil Thompson, who is Sir Melville McNaughton's successor at the Criminal Investigation Department, he wrote a book in the 1930s. In the American edition, he says that that suspect, again, he does not name Druitt, but that's who he's talking about, came to the attention of police whilst alive, but there was not enough evidence to charge him. And we have other sources along those lines. There's a police constable, Robert Spice, who was in his 20s and who left the force under a cloud. And you know, 40 years later, when he's a retired groundsman at a school in London, he claims that he arrested a very respectable doctor on the night of that two women were murdered by the fiend. And he was appalled at the way this man, because of his class status, was able to simply talk his way out of the police station way too easily and too quickly. And we think if you add all of those different indications together, he must have come to police attention and he was able to wriggle his way out of it. And perhaps if he was covered in blood, he could have said, well, I did a bit of medical training, and they would have thought, well, he is Dr. Druitt's nephew, and I was trying to help someone, and that's that. And he probably was released with an apology.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And other points that you make here that point to him being Jack the Ripper, the second one is that he confesses to his cousin, an Anglican priest. Does this also come from the police chief posthumously from Druitt's life?
Yes. Again, it's rather like a black hole. You can't see a black hole in space, but you can see the swirling galaxies that are being gravitationally drawn towards it. And in this case, there is a vicar, a North Country vicar, who in 1899 sends a very strange letter to the Daily Mail in which he says, I know exactly who Jack the Ripper was, and he confessed to a brother clergyman of mine, and he wanted the truth or some of the truth to come out a decade. And that's what I'm doing. And the Daily Mail refused to publish this letter. They just published little glimpses of it. And in fact, they sent a journalist, one of their journalists, to the man's parish to speak to the vicar, to try and get him to go on record. And anyway, he implies that the man committed suicide soon after the last most horrific atrocity, the murder of Mary Jane Kelly. And we think that he's talking about Montagu Druitt. And our evidence for that is two things. One is that there is a leak by a policeman, we believe it's McNaughton, who says that the vicar's ripper drowned himself in the Thames, something the vicar was loath to reveal. And he also says, he also calls his letter to the Daily Mail, strangely enough, the Whitechurch murders. Well, everyone knows it's Whitechapel. Whitechurch is the name of Reverend Charles Druitt's parish in Dorset, who was the son of the famous Dr. Robert Druitt and the cousin of Montagu. He also says at the end, when his interview with the journalist, that the deceased murderer suffered from epileptic mania, which is a Victorianism for committing crimes, but you're in a sort of zombified state and not really in control of yourself. Just the sort of thing a family might want to embrace as an explanation for such evil. And practically at the door, he says to the journalist, look, don't publish my name if you don't mind, because that could give away the name of the murderer. And again, we believe that this indicates that he is related to the murderer's family. And therefore, we put the theory that the vicar who is not identified is Arthur de Borlay Hill, the brother-in-law of Charles Druitt. And he had been a teacher at Winchester. He had taught Montagu. So again, what we're trying to do is reverse engineer what these Victorians knew and what they believed about Montagu Druitt. We can't examine that evidence because they didn't leave that evidence behind, if there was such evidence to leave behind. What we can only do is try and work out what they thought and why they thought what they did. They didn't want us to write this book, if you see what I mean.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. That makes a lot of sense. It isn't laid out clearly. You really have to read between the lines. It's like a criminologist reading Pravda to look at what isn't being said or what is being emphasized in a way. And putting to the idea that this wealthy family is trying to shield him to protect the family name is that he is placed in an expensive asylum in France. So tell me about this, and then also when he escapes.
This was a source, a fellow American of yours, a brilliant writer, researcher on this subject called Roger Palmer. And he sent it to us, and we read it from the Philadelphia Times of 1889. And we were just amazed reading it because we felt that while it does not name Druitt, and perhaps it is about somebody else, there are an awful lot of coincidences about this English patient from a respectable family that has been put in care in a very expensive French asylum, where it turns out that one of the nurses speaks English and realizes that this patient is confessing to being Jack the Ripper, and therefore goes straight to the local French police in order to try and collect the reward. And so the British family have to extract their maniacal member from this asylum and back to London. And it turns out everybody's using false names, and there are just, again, there are indications in that source that match the other sources we have. The two men who are escorting the English, the unnamed English patient, who is in a state of mental distress. One is described as a solicitor who's his friend, and the other man is described as a clergyman who is his cousin. And the one who is the friend is quick to say, and apart from this cousin, he has no other relative. Now, Montagu Druitt's brother, William, who's 1 year older and a solicitor, he appears in the sources that are disguising some of this information as a friend. It was William who was trying to find his brother after he vanished and then eventually discovered that he had drowned himself. This becomes friends looking frantically for the missing doctor. At the inquest at Chiswick, to explain what has happened to his brother, whose body has bobbed up in the Thames River, William Druitt will say a very big lie, but he's obviously trying to protect his family and the memory of Dr. Robert Druitt, because everybody in the audience, all the press, none of whom are the big journalists from the Fleet Street, they're just local journalists, they'd be thinking, Druitt, this man who's been found drowned, Druitt, is he related to Dr. Robert Druitt? And William Druitt just says this bald-faced lie, which is, apart from myself and our mother, who's had to be institutionalized due to a mental illness, he had no other relative. It's almost quoting what will be written in that Philadelphia Times article. And it's Christine who is the person who's found all of these sources that have never been found before. For example, that in fact the coroner, Dr. Thomas Diplock, at that inquiry, whom you'd expect to be a little less credulous at William Druitt's testimony, it turns out that they knew each other or knew of each other because he had conducted just such a inquest about a suicide in that wing of the family, the Robert Druitt wing of the family, a few years before. What he didn't know, I'm sure, was that William Druitt is also desperately covering up for the fact that his brother had a double life as a serial murderer. So we believe that the Philadelphia Times article is talking about Montagu Druitt. We don't know that for a fact. Christine just found various bits and pieces. There's Van Bez Asylum, which pretty much matches a private asylum, extremely expensive. And she found this piece by George Sims called Dr. Swainson's Secret, a short story. We believe that George Sims is up to his neck in this cover-up. He's the chief propagandist of the cover-up for the public. And that story is very similar to Montagu Druitt, and it has a character who is suffering from epileptic mania, who goes into a French asylum. So that's how we put together that.
Christine, can you tell me about these sources, like never-before-published photographs? And I understand the last known image of Druitt. So what were these sources you came across, and how did they help you put together this story?
The main sources that had not been really read through before came from the West Sussex Archive in Chichester. And that archive holds the Druitt Papers, which is a collection of letters from the Druitt family. And there's hundreds of them. People have looked at them before and they've found a few things in there, but really, to my knowledge, nobody has gone in and really read hundreds of those letters. Firstly, to get a feel for the family relationships, which I think is important to know. And secondly, to see if there's anything in those letters suggesting a knowledge about Monty and the possibility that they considered him to be in trouble or to be Jack the Ripper, anything like that. I know people had looked at those letters, and particularly the year 1888, and I've got to say there's not many in that year at all. I imagine when they were looking at them, probably 1888, 1889, they were looking for something that mentioned Jack the Ripper or something quite obvious. Well, people are not going to write that in a letter anyway. The fact that there's hardly any letters in that crucial period in the autumn of 1888 suggested to me that letters had been destroyed. When you read through these family letters, you get a real feel for the relationships. You get a feel for how they speak to each other in the letters. After 1888, a lot of that changes, and there's cryptic references to things in the letter that actually match other sources that we've found. That archive has been crucial, and it took a few years to read through those letters, but that was an important thing for us.
Christine's too modest. I mean, she's found nearly everything. I've never found a thing.
That's not true, but the photograph that you mentioned, that actually, that was a great find. That was really a thrill to find that photograph. It's a photo called the Canning Club in Oxford. And there may be other photographs of Monty Druitt, but we don't know of any that have survived that show him older than in that photograph. So he's probably about 23, around that mark. There are surviving photographs of him at Winchester College. So he's sort of 18, 19 in those, but this is one at Oxford. So that's something that we discovered. It's actually held in the British Library, and that's featured in the book.
Can I just say something else about sources?
Please.
When I first came up with the theory, what I call the case disguise theory, you see, most people who've written on this subject assume that because Sir Melvin McNaughton described Druitt as a middle-aged doctor, and he's actually a young lawyer, you could discount that police chief's opinion. He doesn't know who he's talking about. And what I discovered was that he had written that police memorandum and then circulated it to certain writers who would use not the name, but the profile. And I thought, but there's no way McNaughton would do that and drop the Druitt family in it, because their neighbours would immediately recognise the young lawyer who supposedly was Jack the Ripper and drowned himself in the Thames. So it has to be changed for reasons of discretion. But it also meant that I was arguing that McNaughton had actually misled his colleagues at Scotland Yard. And I could see why he did that as a personality, because he's a very compassionate and affable fellow, but he also outranks everybody at Scotland Yard in terms of class. And I thought that he wouldn't hesitate to do a cover-up that would protect the Druitt family. But the objection to that was, well, that's nice of him, because that's a hell of a gamble he's taking with his police career, which he loves, for a family he doesn't know. And Christine discovered, which I think is one of the key discoveries of our work, is that through looking through Ancestry.com and matching up all the genealogies, she discovered that the Reverend Charles Druitt was married to a woman called Isabel Magendie Hill, and she is a relation of Colonel Sir Vivian Magendie. She has his name. And he worked at the Home Office as a bomb disposal expert. He was a nationally known figure, national hero. He is a very close friend of Sir Melvin McNaughton and of the true crime writer George Sims. And therefore, what Christine had discovered was a personal motive for Sir Melvin McNaughton to run this cover-up. And he probably wanted to bury the whole story, but he knew that vicar was going to make his move within a decade. So they had to get their version of the story out ahead of that vicar. And so it had to go public. And then they quite liked propagating the idea that Scotland Yard was within inches of catching the mad doctor, which again matches the Philadelphia Times piece about the dragnet trying to close in on the English patient, the difference being they don't have his name, whereas in the George Sims version, they're chasing a rich doctor who's mad and they know his name.
Well, I appreciate the way that you have reconstructed the story and taken care to notify what is clearly known and not known, because it's one thing to tell a history of an event where everyone is making the facts known in public, like a military history where the facts on the ground are clear, versus something that could offend powerful parties with vested interests. So people are keeping their cards close to their chest. You have to suss out clues carefully. And I think this is also useful for the listeners to understand how different histories are put together. So something I'm very curious on, not much of this can be known for sure, but how have you reconstructed the story of Druitt as Jack the Ripper? And maybe you don't know everything for sure, but based on your best hypothesis, why did he commit these murders? It sounds like he had a high level of guilt. He confessed to a vicar. He confessed in this asylum. Was he mentally ill? Was he like a Dostoevsky's Raskolnikov in Crime and Punishment, where he thought he had a very good reason to commit these murders and it was for this higher good, but then his conscience ate away at him? Why did he kill himself? So what have you been able to reconstruct from his story? And if you haven't been able to, what is your hypothesis on why he did what he did?
At the time of the murders, it was noticed by, well, just about everybody, they were being committed not just in the East End and not just in Whitechapel, but in a very particular part of that slum, sort of the worst slum, which reformers had called the evil quarter mile. And so some reformers were a bit panicked that perhaps a psychotic amongst their movement for socialistic reform, had taken upon themselves to murder defenseless women in this area in order to draw further attention to the poverty of the area that the ruling classes were neglecting, and that they were the real criminals. And George Bernard Shaw, the playwright, he wrote this satirical letter about how he said, as a socialist, we've gone about this all wrong with pamphlets and marches and speeches, and nothing's come of it. And some independent genius, he puts it tastelessly, has worked out that if you just offer a few dregs, you can turn the property-owning class into a primitive form of communism. And he says, I hope the maniac picks a duchess next and we might be able to have a socialist England. Now, he meant that satirically because he couldn't know what we now know from McNaughton and the other sources in the 1890s, that Montague Druitt, whom they believe was Jack the Ripper, he didn't live in the East End. We believe he worked for a charity called Oxford House, and that's how he was familiar with the slum. But he didn't live there. So if he wants to, because he's sick or mentally ill or depraved, and wants to kill so-called fallen women, he can do it anywhere in London that he likes. He can do it where he lives in Blackheath. But he keeps coming back to Whitechapel, which after the second murder is crawling with police. So he's taking enormous risks to do his evil deeds in that area. And therefore, we think that Shaw was much closer to the truth than he could have realized, that in fact, Montague Druitt was turned on by socialistic ideas. He had noticed the two prostitute murders before he started had brought about favorable press attention. Usually the press would just crucify these women as nymphomaniacs, as moral failures, as deserving of being streetwalkers. And then these two women, who are not connected to each other, but they're killed by separate gangs horrifically, the press does this about face, saying, well, their deaths were terrible, but you know what? Their lives were terrible due to social neglect. And we think Druitt, he began his own reign of terror at that moment in an age which was filled with Irish terrorism. That's why Colonel Sir Vivian Magendie is so celebrated, because he has to disarm a lot of bombs set by Irish terrorists. And he decided that I'm going to turn on the class that produced me, and I'm going to force them to do something about the greater evil of the East End, with some success in terms of the way you see the speeches in the House of Commons saying, well, you know what, we've got to do something. We've got to do something about sanitation and housing and disease and employment, but we don't want to overstretch it. I mean, we could have fun with the term Jack the Socialist, but the point is that he is not someone who is a member of any political organizations, apart from the Conservative Party. He is not someone who has a manifesto that he sends to the government making demands. We think that, like a lot of modern terrorists who barely adhere to the ideology they pretend to be committed to, he just used that in his mind as a way of justifying his own evil. And we think that it left him in a tormented state, and that he confessed to his cousin after the terrible atrocity that was committed on Mary Jane Kelly's remains. And he perhaps feigned to some extent having epileptic mania. I know I'm doing it, but I don't remember it. And whereas Sir Milton McNaughton never bought that. He always calls him a sexual maniac. He enjoys it. He gets off on it. He gets an erotic thrill from mayhem against women who are already degraded. And as I said before, one of Christine's great finds was to discover that Montague Druitt had in fact defended a murderer in court and tried to shift the blame from his client, who was guilty, to a prostitute. And that he was so vitriolic against this woman that she had to leave town for her own safety, even though his client was found guilty. And we think that that agitation he caused awakened something in him that led towards trying to go to the East End, where he was doing charity work already, and killing prostitutes in his mind, because I have a greater mission. I'm doing a greater good through some evil.
Right. There's a lot to untangle, a warped sense of idealism, a warped that expressed itself through mental unwellness and a person who their ideas were filtered in a strange way. It's never easy, even for a psychologist, to untangle all these threads, let alone when the story isn't clear. So the two of you, I mean, you've committed incredible energy and time to putting together this story and identifying Jack the Ripper through these sources, many of which don't seem to want to speak very clearly. So returning to the subject we started with at the beginning of this discussion, we were saying that many people want this alternate account of Jack the Ripper to be true, or the mystery to remain, even though the evidence is clearer than many people pretend to. So why do you think it's important to correctly identify him? Do you think that if we believe stories, even if we probably shouldn't, we lose something? So what do you think is gained by your account and by correctly identifying him?
I think two things. One is that it's always important to dig around in history and discover if something has been forgotten, and in being forgotten, misunderstood. And we think this is actually a misunderstood subject. So that's one. We're trying to correct the historical record. We think that's worth doing. And secondly, we think that these upper-class English gentlemen, McNaughton, Magendie, George Sims, they were anxious to propagate a version of Druitt that would make him unrecoverable to Druitt's neighbours, let alone the press. But we think that they should be applauded for the fact that they didn't go for blaming the murders on a more handy villain of popular prejudice, like somebody foreign, an immigrant, Jewish, poor. Instead, they were going to say the essential truth to the public. It was Jack the Gentleman, like it or lump it. It was one of us, not one of them. And the better classes weren't happy with that solution, but that was what it had to be, because that was the broad or even specific truth, the class truth. It was a Gentile and not a Jewish person. And we think that is worth remembering and publishing now, that they tried to say, in an era of tremendous prejudice, we live in an age of prejudice too. And we think it's important that these men were trying to rise above their class and their particular sectarian ethnic identities to say, it was someone who is the best of Britain did this. not someone who's a foreigner or an outsider. And that's quite a cultural achievement. In fact, its legacy is the iconic image of the toff in a top hat and carrying a medical bag.
Right. If nothing else, it democratizes the idea of who could do something like this. So there is something to respect there. Well, this discussion, I mean, it reminds me that writing history like this oftentimes isn't easy. And so I appreciate the forensic work the two of you have done together. And there's a lot more to unpack. For those who want to see the story in full, the name of the book is The Escape of Jack the Ripper, The Truth About the Cover-Up and His Flight from Justice. Jonathan and Christine, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you, Mr. Rank.
There you have it. That is all for today's episode. Once again, I want to start things off by thanking the Spymasters of History Unplugged. I'll explain what that is in a second. Our Spymasters include Bill Ivey, Moondoggy from Ohio, Tom from Ohio, Ryan Gillen, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael from New York, Carl from Norway, Josh Reddick, Jennifer French Lee, Jay Carrington, McCrays, Salvador Sanchez, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Fraser. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams, where I do live versions of podcast episodes, where you can leave feedback as I'm talking, and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, you get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a three-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.